Hello and welcome to a special edition of The Family Show on Holy Family Radio. I'm your host, Eleanor Rawson, and I've recently heard the most amazing story of faith, family, trust, surrender, love. I could go on and on, but I found it so compelling that we wanted to share it with you, with the Holy Family Radio listening audience. So today I'm joined in the studio by Sharon, Kelly, and Shannon. And they're all from St. Leo's Parish in Lancaster to share their incredible story with us. Thank you, ladies, for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let me just briefly tee this up by saying that a person who figures prominently in the story was familiar to me and will probably be remembered by many of our listeners, and that is Father Michael Judge. Father Michael was the chaplain of the New York firefighters who performed so heroically at the World Trade Center on 9/11. In fact, his was the first recorded death at that site, which was news to me actually doing some research.
Yes.
But I do think a lot of our listeners will remember that picture, that photograph showing the body of Father Michael being carried out of Tower 1 by first responders. That just is so in the forefront of my mind from those days. But what I want to ask you now, and I'm going to start with you, Sharon, with that backdrop, how did your family come to meet Father Judge?
Well, my husband first met Father Michael in 1961 in St. Joseph's Parish in East Rutherford, New Jersey. It was a Franciscan parish at the time. It's no longer a Franciscan parish. And he was an altar server for him. And then my husband's father was very ill, and Father Michael would come to the house and sing Irish songs with his dad because he was dying. And then, you know, we ran away to get married. We eloped, and we went back and saw Father Michael and said, "Well, marry us in the church now." And he said, "No, I really can't do that."
Really?
And we said, "Well, that isn't really going to work out too well." But anyway, then we made up. We were very, very, very close after that. And our house happened to be right behind the church on the next block. So all the priests from St. Joseph's would show up at our house after Easter Mass or after Ash Wednesday or after whatever. And we would always have them in our house. My children were always raised with Father Michael being somewhere in our life.
Okay. Now, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but I remember speaking to Kelly, your daughter, before this, and she had mentioned how you guys used to go up to New York because you moved away from New York at some point. Mm-hmm. You maintained that relationship with Father Michael, but you moved away. But you used to go up and visit him. Is that right?
Yes, because we used to talk to him on the phone, you know, and things. So we never lost the relationship whatsoever. Mm-hmm. He would call. My husband's birthday is February 24th, and Father Michael's ordination is February 25th.
Okay.
So he would always call us in the middle of the night. It would be 1 o'clock in the morning because he would always remember my husband's birthday.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, so yes, I took my children as children. I would take them into Manhattan to give away socks and things to homeless people that were on the street. So we were always in Manhattan.
But why? Was it something that Father Michael was doing already that influenced you to do that?
Yes, he was working on the bread line. His job at that point was the bread line at St. Francis.
Okay.
Since 1929, they've been giving meals 365 days a year.
Wow.
Yes. So so we would give him, you know, a couple of bucks, and he would give it out to the guys. And so, yes, but we always kept a relationship. My husband was discerning to become a priest. We took him in to see him and talk to him. Many, 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 you know, opportunities to go see Father.
So Father was connected even at that time with the homeless.
Yes.
Okay. And that influenced you as far as raising your kids and having a relationship with Father Michael.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, yes. Because Father Michael taught me something that I wish the whole world could learn, because people look at the homeless in a different way than Father Michael ever did. And one time I went to him, probably in the confessional, and I said, "You got to help me, because I look at these guys and I think they're strong and they look great, and why aren't they working? And I'm just struggling with this." And he said, "They are hungry. You give them food."
Yeah.
End of the story. that's right now they're hungry. So it gave me an opportunity to look at it from a whole new perspective that it doesn't matter to me their story. If they were hungry, my job and my duty as a Catholic and a Christian and a human being was to give them food if I had it.
And I think a lot of us struggle with that. You know, a lot of times in our parishes, even in the Diocese of Harrisburg, you know, we'll go to a church on Sunday and somebody's standing out there, or we go to the grocery store, somebody's out there. We think, oh, should we give somebody money? Because what if they're using it for crack or for alcohol? And
well, you know how I do it is if I give it to them and they don't need it, it's their sin. If they need it and I don't give it to them, it's my sin.
That's a good way to put it.
So that's how I just function in this whole situation with taking care of the homeless and poor. I try to look at it like Father Michael taught me, you know, just deal with the situation.
Right.
They need underwear. They need shoes. It doesn't matter why. That's really not, has nothing to do with the fact of the need of their situation.
Okay. Before I say that, I want to mention that if you heard a little baby in the background, there are four in the studio with me, and I'm not going to get into little Luke's story yet, but you're going to hear about this baby too. But in the meantime, Kelly, what did you think of your mom taking you guys up to Manhattan, going in and buying socks to give away? I mean, most kids want to get something for themselves, and you were up there to take socks to give out to the homeless?
Yeah, I just remember it just being very natural. You know, we didn't grow up looking at the homeless as they're different, don't go near them. We grew up, thanks to my parents, with these are people in need and let's help them.
Yeah.
And my mom bought socks because, you know, her and my dad, they had three kids and that was what they could afford. When we went into Manhattan to see the Macy's windows or for whatever reason we were there, my mom would always buy a few packs of socks and give each of us kids some to put in our pockets, and we would just give them away to people that we saw that needed them.
So how did you stay in touch with him after you left? I mean, you obviously were living here, I'm thinking, or in this area. And, you know, you talked to him on the phone. You'd go up how many times a year to Manhattan to visit him?
Times.
Oh, many times, not just to Christmas time.
Well, you know what? We started out in Bergen County. So no matter where we live, we're still New Yorkers at heart.
Okay.
Do you know? So
yeah.
We still go to New York.
We were just there last week.
Oh, yeah. You were? Okay.
Oh, yeah. We go to New York for the day.
Oh, I know. I was on the phone with you.
Yes.
No.
So New York is not far for us.
Right.
It's a day trip.
Yeah. So, you know, we're just New Yorkers at heart. So we're always there. We're always there.
And so this relationship that started with your husband as an altar server and continued on through your marriage with your husband, what do you think made Father Michael so special? You know, I know he was involved with the homeless, but he really became kind of famous.
That's impossible to.
And he has his own backstory too. When I was doing some research for the program, I saw that he was a recovering alcoholic, and he was open about that.
Mm-hmm.
And he just—I remember one story where people talked about him and say, you know, if there was a fire, he was the first one in the door.
Right.
There was an example of a guy who, a young man, I think, and his wife—I might have the details not quite right—but who was contemplating suicide and maybe also killing this woman who was either pregnant or had.
Yes, that's true.
And he said, "Let me in.
Yes.
Let me in."
I think my husband was there.
He was there. An eyewitness to that.
That is true. Yeah, that is a true story.
And
yeah.
They waited and waited and waited. And what happened next?
They got him down. He got him out and nothing bad happened.
Yeah, my dad just told me the story.
He just did. And he promised the man that they would go for coffee. So Father Michael, that's how he got him out.
Mm-hmm.
So Father Michael told the police and the firemen that were there, you are not taking him until we go for coffee. And they actually let him go for coffee with the guy and then they took him. Whatever.
So that kind of speaks volumes to
He was an ordinary man who did extraordinary things.
Mm-hmm.
He really, truly was.
Exactly.
How has he helped you? I mean, have you been lifelong Catholics? Obviously, you said when you were married, you lived in your parish up there. But
absolutely. Yes. Yes. Since day one. I was born a Catholic, stayed a Catholic. Love being a Catholic.
Raised your children Catholic.
Raised my children Catholic. You know, buried my mother Catholic, buried my father Catholic. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Father Michael just was always there. I don't know he was just always a part of our life.
Why don't you give the example about when Bobby was born?
Now, who's Bobby?
My brother.
My son was born, and he needed a blood exchange. He was very ill. He was very ill. His bilirubin was very high. They were expecting brain damage and whatever. So they had to take his blood out and put new blood in. And all of a sudden, in the elevator, my husband runs into Father Michael.
At the hospital.
At the hospital.
Wow.
But my husband said, why are you here, Father?
And well, he hadn't said, called him or anything.
No.
He just ran
no,
into him.
Because it happened so quick.
Okay.
He said, Father Michael said, I don't know. I just thought I was supposed to be here. Here I am.
No kidding.
So there he was. I mean, he was just, that's who he was.
Mm-hmm. He said yes.
He always said yes.
Yeah. He felt the interior calling of the Holy Spirit and he responded yes.
Did you know much about his prayer life? I mean, was he I know there's,
he
was a
the
very,
rosary.
I was going to say he was very
rosary.
Active, but let's talk about that a little bit. How do you know that he loved the rosary? Just from what he would tell you or encourage you?
He always had his rosary in his hand. He was always, yes. And he has a special spot in St. Francis down below.
Lower church.
In the lower church. There's a special pew that he would always go to. And you could always find him there if he was home. You could find him there with his rosary in his hand. And
that,
when he died, they said he was seen with a rosary behind his back.
And he prayed the rosary with our friend Stephen McDonald, who passed away about a year ago.
That's a big connection, too.
Now, tell our listeners who Stephen McDonald is.
Stephen McDonald is a New York City police detective who was shot in Central Park in 1989. And he was shot by a 15-year-old boy by name of Shavad Jones, who was a bike thief. And Stephen was left paralyzed from the neck down and lived his entire life in a wheelchair, praying to God, praising God, speaking about forgiveness. He went and forgave the young man who shot him.
Okay.
And Father Michael was instrumental in helping him do that. Father Michael, again, heard about this detective who had been shot, and he knew in his heart he needed to go there.
So he didn't know him.
Nope.
He just heard about it.
No.
And he went right after it happened then. He was out of the country, actually, when it happened.
Okay. Returned to the country and then realized that he should go be with Stephen.
Okay.
And he actually, when Patty Ann was pregnant, Stephen's wife had the baby. Father Michael did the things with the baby that poor Stephen in a wheelchair couldn't do. He took him to Disney World. He played baseball with him. He did all those things.
Poor Stephen.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. We're not finished with Father Michael, but we're going to stop and take a break. And when we come back, we're going to hear about Father Michael and his relationship with your daughter, Kelly, your daughter, Shannon. And it just gets more and more amazing. So we invite our listeners to stay tuned. We'll be right back. Okay, we are back with the Hickey Lynch family and their incredible story. Now, at this time, I want to talk about the story within the story. There's many layers to this. Kelly, let's talk about the time your daughter Shannon was just a baby. She was very ill. Tell us about that and how Father Michael was involved at that time.
Okay, Shannon was 7 weeks old when she was diagnosed with biliary atresia, which is a liver disease. At that time, it was affecting 1 in 25,000 babies. And without a liver transplant, Shannon would die. And the doctors expected that she would die between her first and second birthdays. At that time, they were just beginning an experimental program. Shannon was born in June of 90, and in November of 89, they did the first living donor transplant. But we didn't know that when she was diagnosed.
Yeah, you must have felt like you were hit by a Mack truck.
I was 23, and all I ever wanted was to be a mother. And there was my beautiful baby, and she was dying. She was getting sicker every day. Her belly was distended. She was so yellow. And I remember one of the first things I did was I called Father Michael, and I told him that my baby was very sick and she was dying and I needed his help. I needed him to pray for her and pray over her and bless her. And it was my father and Father Michael Judge that basically told me what I needed to do next.
Okay. In so many words, what?
They told me that I needed to give Shannon back to God.
Oh. That at this point, you're trying to save your baby's life. You're trying to figure out where you go next to do that. And they're saying to you, get ready to give back your baby.
Right.
And how, as a mother,
it was very hard. I was young and it was very, very hard. I remember saying to my dad, all I ever wanted was a baby. God has finally given me this baby and you're telling me I have to give this baby back. And I don't remember if it was my dad or Father Michael, but the two of them were very present at that time, saying to me that God couldn't work in her until I let go of her and gave her back to him.
Mm-hmm.
And
were the doctors saying to you, there's really nothing we can do for this baby? I mean, was she on a liver transplant, list?
The doctor in New York said they did a surgery on her when she was 7.5 weeks old. It was called a Kasai, and that was to hopefully buy her some more time before needing the transplant. For Shannon, that did not work. So I remember the day we were in Mount Sinai Hospital and the doctors, the transplant surgeon and the gastroenterologist said to me, your baby will die between her first and second birthdays without a transplant. And at the time, there was such, I mean, there still is such a shortage of organs. People die waiting.
Okay. So Father Michael and your dad, Kelly, are saying to you, you need to you need to just give her back to God and let God do his will. In the meantime, you're thinking, what else can we do to save this daughter?
Right.
At that time, how were liver transplants being done with children? I mean, as young as 7 months, was it even possible?
Well, it was only cadaver transplants done, as far as I knew, and no one in New York offered us any other option. But my mom called the American Liver Foundation and asked for information. And they sent her a pamphlet, which I still to this day have. Mm-hmm. And in this pamphlet, there was one little tiny sentence or two, and it said, Dr. Christoph Ebrols just performed the first living donor liver transplant at the University of Chicago.
Ah, okay.
And no internet then. Remember, we're talking right. 28 years ago. You couldn't click and find anything.
Oh, that's a good point, because we're so used to being able to get instant information.
You call and they send you a pamphlet in the mail.
You got it in the mail.
Yes.
So, okay, you get this in the mail. You see this blurb. There has to be this light bulb that goes off in your head that says, who is this doctor? We need to talk to him. Like,
you call
now.
Me at work. Called her right away at work and said, listen, this is what I found. I can't even say it.
Yeah. It's okay.
And maybe there's hope for us, because at that point, we had been praying and praying and praying. I didn't even sleep.
Right.
I said, I won't sleep. Let me pray all night for something good to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so exhausted from all this. Plus, she had to go to work.
And we're taking care of a sick baby.
And she was very ill. We didn't want to lose the insurance. In those days, you know, there was a thing that, you know, if you had a pre-existing condition.
Yeah.
I mean, there were many, many things that were not a problem now.
Not in your favor,
yeah. Then.
Mm-hmm.
So I was totally exhausted. And when I found that, it was like, oh, my God, like, it's maybe this is the Holy Spirit, who I firmly trust and love.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is that one sentence jumped out at me. So I called her and said, and the rest.
And I picked up the phone and I called. 411, I need a number for University of Chicago Hospitals. I called. I asked for Dr. Christoph Brolsch's office. Within minutes, he was on the phone with me.
Swear.
He was on the phone with me.
He answered.
The head surgeon of this.
Had you at this
program.
Point given Shannon to God?
Yes, it was right. I gave Shannon to God right before this happened.
Okay.
Because when I gave Shannon to God, I was all alone. I was in my little apartment in Mansfield Township, New Jersey. And I can still see it, because I was in a bathrobe in the middle of the night. Shannon didn't sleep because she was too sick. And all night she would sleep in her swing. And this one night she was crying, and I took her out of the swing. I held her up and I was on my knees, because Father Michael told my dad that there's something very humbling about getting on your knees to pray.
Mm-hmm.
And I often don't get on my knees except if I'm in church.
Right.
And I got on my knees and I held her up and I lifted her up and I said, okay, God, here she is. She's yours. Do with her what you will. I accept it.
So that's very important at this point, that you surrendered her back to God.
Yes. And then the doors open.
Then the doors open. So
one after
happened,
another.
When you talked to that surgeon in Chicago, what did he tell you to do?
He told me over the phone, he said, your daughter does need a liver transplant, just from what I told him. I told him the liver numbers. I told him where we were at. He mm-hmm. said, she needs a liver transplant. You need to come to Chicago. And so I spent the next month and a half, 2 months, fighting an insurance company, because it was an experimental surgery.
Mm,
and I gave them a pretty good case. I fought hard and I won. And we flew to Chicago.
We had to get an attorney, though.
We did. We had to get an attorney to help us.
Okay.
And we called the newspaper and they put it on the front page, and it was right before Christmas. And there she was, as yellow as can be, in this beautiful red and white outfit. And the community all stepped up to help.
Well, you're talking about two formidable mothers here. Kelly, you and your mom. I can see you guys. I can just see it in your eyes. I wish people could see that right now. So you went to Chicago. Well, you still got to get a liver.
Yes. This operation was called Living Related Donor Liver Transplant.
And
okay. involved using a portion of a living adult's liver and transplanting it into the child. And the benefit is the child is still relatively healthy, because children on waiting lists for livers have to get very sick before they actually get the liver.
Right.
So this was, you could choose the date, you could do it when you were ready, but you had to be a match.
Mm-hmm.
And they were only, at that time, University of Chicago was the only hospital allowed to do them. They were only granted permission from the federal government to do 20.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew to Chicago. We had to go through the evaluation first.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go through a thorough evaluation. They had to check what my liver looked like, if it was possible.
So they're looking at you as a possible donor because you've got to be a relative.
Well, there was no doubt in my mind that I was going to be her donor.
Oh, okay.
However, I had such a line of people. My mother, my father, my brother, my sister, everybody was lined up. If you're not a match, I'll do it. If you're not a match, I'll do it. Everybody wanted to save Shannon.
Yes. So what happened then? They're checking you first, probably.
Right. And they told me that I was a match.
Yeah.
And I remember we were so excited. You know, there was no internet back then, but somehow word got out. Kelly's a match. You know, a couple of phone calls back home. And and so they we found out on my birthday, my 23rd birthday. We were in Chicago. We found out that day. And then we scheduled the transplant for the following January. It was January 29th, 1991.
Now, Shannon's very ill. I'm sure she's continuing to get sick.
She was deteriorating every day.
Okay, so this was a struggle every day.
Every day.
All right.
And, you know, she had what's called ascites. Basically, since her liver had stopped working, there was so much fluid in her abdomen that I actually wrote a letter to the Huggies Corporation because I had to buy the largest size diapers on my little seven-month-old baby just to get them around her abdomen.
Oh, my goodness.
And they sent me all kinds of diapers, you know.
Amazing. Boy, people are out there. They really want to help, don't they?
Yes.
She was on a special formula, too, because she couldn't digest regular formula.
Right.
And it was, I
and
think
all
at
sorts
that
of vitamins.
It was maybe $25 a can, which 28 years ago, that was a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
And we couldn't get it one day. I remember we called that. We
had to get
we
it from a pharmacy.
And the man wasn't, a watchman actually went in and got a can of it and mailed it and mailed it. A night watchman opened the, absolutely opened the office or whatever, where the storage, the warehouse, and got us this Prosobi. Prosobi, it was called, wasn't it? Prosobi.
I don't
remember.
That's just amazing. So you just, people in every walk of life, just trying to.
I always say, if it's right, it's easy.
Yeah.
If it's right, it's easy.
There
it
you
works
go.
Out. Yeah.
So, okay, let's go up to that date. You go to surgery. They take part of your liver, right?
Yes.
Okay. And they put your liver, take hers out, put yours in.
Yes.
How optimistic were they that this would work?
Well, we were looking at statistics at the time, and because only 16 had been done, we would be the number 17th. I was looking at which babies survived. Did any donors die? Because part of it was accepting the fact that I could die.
Right. Any major surgery.
At 23, you're kind of invincible. You don't think you're going to die. I was more worried that my daughter would die.
Right.
And
I was more worried that they would all die.
I see that. Yeah.
And I remember that morning, I prayed specifically to the Blessed Mother. And I said, every time my daughter's eyes are opened, she sees me or my mom or my dad at that time. And it was the three of us pretty much that she saw when she opened her eyes. And I prayed to the Blessed Mother, when she opens her eyes, if she sees anything in surgery, let her see you. Let you comfort her as a mother, because I, as a mother, am in surgery and can't.
Right. Oh, that's so beautiful.
Yeah. I they took me in first around 5 a.m. And then a little while later, they came and took Shannon. And for me, it was the fastest day of my life because I went to sleep and I woke up.
That's right.
For my parents, it was the longest day of their lives because their daughter and granddaughter were in surgery for 15 hours.
When did you get an inkling that this surgery was doing well?
That she had
pink feet.
Pink feet.
She had pink feet for the
when
first
I woke
time.
Up, I was...
How soon after the surgery?
Immediately when I
her
saw
feet
her.
Feet turned pink.
She had pink feet.
And they were yelling it through the halls, her pink feet are pink. Her feet
instead
are pink.
Instead of being green, like orangey green.
Yeah.
They were pink.
Yeah.
That must have been such a thrill. And you probably saw that first, Sharon, right?
I did.
You as her grandmother.
Yeah, I went to her first.
And what I did back then, before cell phones, I wanted to know if she survived. And I was so afraid that everyone would try to protect me if she died and not tell me.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought a Polaroid instant camera with us. And I had them take pictures of Shannon and bring them to me in recovery.
The hospitals were connected by, that was two hospitals.
Two different hospitals.
They were connected by a walkway.
And I'm sure Father Michael was praying for you.
Oh, yes.
Was with you probably in body and spirit this whole time. Because he loved your family and you loved him so much. And he would say so? That he
was... there were little pink while you were out slips at the Ronald McDonald House every time we got back. Father Michael Judge called. He's praying. And he would call the hospital. He'd break. They wouldn't let calls come in because it was a pediatric hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Very late. But he would find a way to get those nurses to put his call through.
Yes. When the phone rang at 11 or 12 o'clock, you knew it was Father Michael.
Yeah.
So they turned off the phones, I think, at 10.
The nurses would say, I've got Father Michael Judge on the phone. Can I pass him through?
You're afraid. Do you know this guy?
Yeah.
And he spoke to us and he said... Because Shannon wasn't, I mean, there were ups and downs for that surgery. And he would always say, God hasn't created tomorrow yet. Would you just get out of it? Just get out of tomorrow,
just
Shannon.
Just live in today.
You know, I mean, And that's what I tried to do. You try to do what he said anyway.
Yeah. I hate to do this, but we have to stop here. But we're going to invite our listeners to join us for part two of this special edition of The Family Show next Friday at 12:30 on 720 AM Holy Family Radio. Tune in, tell your friends. You will not believe what happens next. We are back with the second part of the special edition of The Family Show and the amazing story of the Hickey Lynch family. Last time we were together, Kelly and Shannon, well, actually Sharon was in here too. You told us how you met Father Michael Judge, who we remember died at 9/11 at the World Trade Center attacks, and the support and comfort he provided your family when Shannon needed a liver transplant at 7 months of age. Okay, so let's fast forward now. Shannon has a liver transplant at about 7 months of age. Kelly, you are the donor.
Yes.
This was rarely done. Was there one case that was done, a living donor transplant at that point?
At that point, there were 16. We were
okay.
Number 17.
Well, okay. It's the top 20, right?
Yes, the first 20 in the United States.
So now, Shannon does beautifully with mom's liver for 28 years. Okay, that's an incredible story on its own. But then, Shannon, you run into a problem. At this point, Shannon, you're married, mm-hmm. and you and your husband are about to adopt a baby. What happened?
So I go for routine blood work every few months, and I went for some routine blood work, and all the results came back, and all of my liver numbers were like off the charts. Nothing was in normal range. So I got a hold of my liver team that's in New York City, and they brought me in into the hospital, and I was diagnosed with acute liver rejection.
This was last February
yes.
of 2018. So this mm-hmm. is a very recent happening.
Yeah, very recent.
So Kelly, you're freaking out, I would imagine.
Oh, yes. The dreaded word of rejection that we feared from the day of her transplant was all of a sudden a reality.
Which you've never heard till now.
Never. She never had any rejection.
But
we feared it terribly.
But you feared it. But Shannon, you were always, you know, getting your blood work done mm-hmm. just to be on top of it. So you get this devastating news. And it's, are they saying rejection?
Yeah. And really.
Yeah, they said they suspected it, right?
Yeah. Once I got to the hospital, right. It was rejection. And really in 28 years, I was young. I don't remember the transplant. So in 28 years, I really wasn't faced with anything with mm-hmm. my liver. Everything, mm-hmm. honestly, some days I forget that I had a liver transplant because my health is so great.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the first time in 28 years that I was really faced with something that I wasn't prepared for.
What did you do next?
Well, I was in the hospital, and the first time I was in the hospital, they did a huge round of IV steroids, and I was in the hospital for about a week with a ton of IV steroids, other medications. They sent me home in the hopes that that worked,
mm-hmm.
and that was the plan. I was going to get my labs checked every week,
mm-hmm.
and I went home. I was home for 2 weeks, and I was getting my labs checked. Nothing was improving, but they said in the first week, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. things look a little weird. Give it another week.
Mm-hmm.
And by the second week, my numbers were even worse than they were the first time I went into the hospital.
Mm.
So they brought me back in, and I had to have a treatment. And I was in the hospital for about 9 days. And in between these hospital visits, like you said, my husband and I were adopting, and my son was born.
Okay.
So in those 2 weeks, it was a very hectic time, and I was really, really hoping that all the treatments
this
that they
would
had
all
done,
go away. Yeah,
yeah, I really was. I was pretty optimistic.
Okay.
But unfortunately, I had to go back, and that was really hard.
Now, let me just interject something right here, because at this time, obviously, Father Michael Judge had passed away back mm-hmm. in 2011 or 2001. Did you have a relationship with him prior to his passing? And did you, when this happened, did you particularly, maybe say a prayer, "Hey, Father Michael, can you intercede here? Because you've been such a good family intercessor."
Yeah. So he had always been a huge part of my entire family's life forever. And he was just kind of always there. He was just that person that was always there. And I mean, I was young at the time, so I don't remember him 100% like everybody else probably does, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I know and I remember his presence in my entire family's life and especially mine.
Okay.
So I've always, since his passing, especially, I've always prayed to him. I feel like we have an even almost like a, in death, we almost have like a closer bond because I pray to him every single day.
And I heard prior to this that every year of the anniversary of your transplant, you guys have a big party.
Yeah.
I mean, a big party.
Yeah.
And Kelly, your mom said to me, this is a bigger deal than her birthday.
No,
this
it is.
This is like the
it
big
is.
Party.
Yeah.
So tell
we celebrate
us,
life.
Tell us about that party and what, and something happened to change, you know, this normal party that you had. This is before you got sick, though. These are over the years.
Yeah.
What happened at one of those particular anniversaries that you were talking about gifts and what you wanted for gifts?
That was when she was 11, the year after Father Michael died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the year after Father Michael died. Obviously, we were used to doing a huge party every year with cake, presents, gifts. It was a huge celebration. But after Father Michael died, there was just this sadness, and it didn't feel right having this huge celebration, even though it still was a celebration of my life. It didn't feel right doing it without him. So I came up with this idea that I wanted to still have the party. And I was 11 at the time, and I wanted my friends, instead of bringing presents for me, I asked them, because at the time I loved socks.
Okay.
And it was just an 11-year-old's thing. I loved getting a new pair of socks. So in my head,
more full of them.
Yeah. So in my head, I thought, well, the homeless would love socks too.
Yeah.
And so I asked my friends to bring new socks, and I wanted to donate them to the homeless. So instead of gifts for me, I wanted to get gifts for the homeless. And honestly, it was such a small idea at the time. I never really, at that age, I didn't really grasp like the meaning behind it and really how big this could become. So my mom, my dad, my grandparents, they reached out to family, friends, local radio, news, all that, without telling me, and surprised me. And people were sending in boxes of socks. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up with 1,500 pairs of socks.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. So
more
at that
point, more than a dwarful.
Right. So at that point, you kind of look at 1,500 pairs of socks and
it was a mountain.
Yeah.
So what did you do with them?
So we went into New York City. Mm-hmm. We went to the breadline that Father Michael.
Because you had been going anyway, right? As
yes.
a family.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
But so we never actually worked on the breadline. We had brought things in, given it to the homeless when Father Michael was around. We'd visit him there. But to actually be on the breadline that he worked on, that was pretty humbling.
Wow. Okay. So you're on the breadline and you're giving out these socks.
Yeah. And while we were on the breadline, a homeless man approached my Nana and asked her if she had a clean pair of underwear. And we didn't. And so we got in the car, and I remember being in the car, and it kind of haunted all of us that you really have to humble yourself to ask a complete stranger on the street for a pair of underwear, something that's such a necessity that we take for granted every day.
I mean, you can go to a thrift shop, but you can't go in a thrift shop and get underwear. You can get a coat, you can get a jacket, you can get, but you don't get underwear, right? Okay.
So we went home, and for my Nana's birthday, then coming up, she asked everybody to give her men's and women's underwear. So that started the second project.
Blessed Bloomers.
Blessed Bloomers, we called it. And we collected underwear. And then we went back to the breadline and gave the underwear to the men and women. And really, every single time we went to the breadline, a new need presented itself. Hmm. And really, I feel that in those moments is how our ministry was created.
Okay.
It started with such a small idea, and we never, I never intended for it to be this big ministry that would do all these things, but it turned into something so much bigger and more beautiful than I ever intended.
So was that the beginning of Michael's message?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that started after he died.
Mm-hmm.
You guys got really involved in that, really involved in the bread line, collecting these first socks. Then you started with underwear. And then you're going how often now to New York?
A couple times a year to New York. Philadelphia.
Yeah, I was saying you were distributing this stuff other places, weren't you?
We were just in Harlem. We distributed Christmas stockings, 50 Christmas stockings for men at a shelter called Create, mm-hmm. rehabilitation center. And there are 50 men living there. So we brought them all Christmas stockings filled with pajama pants, socks, underwear, a watch. They usually get a watch each year, scarf.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I'm going to backtrack a little bit because we're almost getting a little bit ahead of our story. But I know it's beautiful how, like, this whole story has blossomed into this ministry.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to Shannon when you were back in the hospital.
Yeah.
You're married. You have a baby you're adopting who's been born.
Yep.
And you are being told you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
You're not getting better with the steroids. So what happens next?
So the second time I'm in the hospital, I got a very, very intensive treatment, through IV. It was the hope that would kind of reverse the liver rejection.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't really a guarantee, but they said that it's going to be really tough on your body.
Didn't this knock out your whole immune system?
Yes. So they said it's going to be really, really rough on your body. It's literally just going to knock your entire immune system out.
Mm-hmm.
And basically we're going to knock it out to rebuild it back up.
Was that a concern that you wouldn't have an immune system for a week? I mean, I guess at that point you had to do whatever
concern,
they told you.
But it was a greater concern that she was rejecting her liver.
Yeah.
All right. So then what happens?
So then I was doing way better than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
The first 3 days I was prepared for a horrible, this treatment and all that from what they were saying.
So they told you expect this not to be pleasant.
Right.
It's going to be very, very hard on your body.
Mm-hmm. I was doing relatively well for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to bed on the third day in the hospital thinking that I actually might be able to go home the next day earlier than expected.
You know what? It was you had four treatments.
Okay.
So the fourth day must have been a little rough, right? But then it was the fourth night you went to bed, and that's when.
So then I wake up, and
on the fifth day,
the only thing I can really explain it is that I could not move anything from my neck down.
I'm going to stop you right here. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and find out. I'm like on the edge of my seat. What happened next? Something really incredible. We're back with a special edition of The Family Show. Shannon, you were talking about, you had a liver transplant when you were 7 months old, and you do fine for 28 years, but now things are taking a turn for the worse. Your numbers are bad. You're on this treatment that's not promising much, but you're feeling pretty good the first 3-4 days, and then things turn suddenly very bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I wake up at about 3 a.m., and it started out with just a headache. And it was so intense. I've never experienced anything like that. And it slowly, started to just take over my entire head. And then I could not move. The only thing I could move was my eyeballs.
And Kelly, you're here with her. I mean, you're in the hospital. Kelly, you're up here. I think you told me you're staying at a convent.
Yes.
And so
she texted me, and I woke up and saw the text, and I got in the car. And
what did
right
she
there.
Say?
Something's wrong. Something's not right. I'm sure of it. I'm in a lot of pain. Something's very wrong.
Okay. So what are you thinking, Shannon?
Well, at this point, I have no idea what's going on because I've been reacting so well up to this point to this treatment. So I was very confused. The mm-hmm. doctors were confused. The nurses.
Yeah, everybody.
Everybody was scrambling. No one knew what was going on, which I think was even scarier that no one knew what was happening. So as literally the minutes are going by, I'm getting worse by the minute.
Lost your hearing?
I lost hearing in my left ear. By the time my mom got to the hospital, I think literally the only thing I could move were my eyeballs back and forth. I could barely speak and
couldn't open her mouth.
Yeah.
So Kelly, you're seeing Shannon, you're saying to yourself, this is really bad.
Yeah, I knew the minute I looked at her, I knew something was very wrong.
And so what happened then? What did you do?
I just started calling the nurses and the PA and the doctors. They sent an ENT up. They examined her. I've never known anyone with meningitis. I've never seen meningitis. I just know of it. And when the ENT came in to examine her, I said, there's no chance it's meningitis, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were sure it wasn't.
Spiritually, what's happening to you?
Spiritually, I was fighting. I was fighting because I knew that I needed to let go, and I couldn't. I recall saying to my mom on the phone, I will not live my life without her. I will not. I'm not going to lose her.
Okay. So because you had surrendered her once before.
Right.
Right. And right. you're probably facing this thought of like, do I have to do this again?
I remember thinking it was so much harder. I remember thinking the first time was easier. This time is harder. Maybe it's because I don't have Father Michael. And I was alone. I was in New York. I was all alone in the hospital with her. And she was deteriorating quickly. And nobody really had any answers. They were taking her for one test and another test. And then the nursing coordinator came in and said to me, you need to get pictures of the baby and put them all around the room because she's losing hope and she's not wanting to fight. And so I scurried and found a way to get pictures printed. And I made purple glove garland. And so that when she did open her eyes, she would see something that was bright and hopeful. And I filled the room with Bible verses that I had written on scrap papers. And
but you can see that she is in terrible pain. And
she
there's
was
nothing
in the
you
worst.
Yeah, and they were giving
I was helpless.
You all kinds of medication.
They gave her everything you can think of.
And nothing was touching your
nothing
pain.
Nothing even touched the pain.
Until they gave her the IV morphine.
Yeah, until that. But that had been, I mean, that had been
hours.
Like 10 hours of excruciating pain.
So you're witnessing like an agony. What did you tell me?
I refer to it as her agony in the garden. And I've never in my life witnessed anybody suffering that I loved so much right before my eyes.
And you felt helpless,
nothing
right?
Nothing I could do.
So at that point, now you know, as a prayerful person, as a Catholic, and are you reaching out to other people to say, can you please pray for my daughter?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I had 3 text groups going. I had 30 people in each one, and I had Facebook. I was posting everywhere, texting everyone, and I had the greatest community of prayer warriors going on that day and that night that today, to this day, they all will say to me, I know exactly where I was when the text came through.
Mm-hmm.
Because we stopped everything we were doing to pray for Shannon.
Okay. Did that image come back to you way back when she was a baby, where your dad and Father Michael were saying to you, give her to God?
Yes, I knew it. In my mind, I knew it. But in my heart, I just couldn't let go. I was so afraid that if I let go, he might choose to take her.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that the surrender, the total surrender was, your will, not mine. If you choose to take her, I accept it. And I knew I couldn't just say it. I had to feel it. I had to believe it, because you have to believe it in order for it to be. And I didn't get to the point until about 7:15 that night, after they'd whisked her out of her room and put her into a room where they could monitor her closer.
And Shannon, do you know what's going on now? You're being whisked into this other room. You said the only thing that moved are your eyeballs.
Yeah.
Your mom's in the room. You know she's there.
Yeah.
Are people coming and going? You had another priest.
Father
Michael was gone then, but
right.
You had a priest. Was he a family friend?
This Father Ridley that showed up out of nowhere in the hospital.
Oh, okay.
I don't even know if he exists. He just showed up and prayed with us, and he was there every time something happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're being whisked around. You're absolute at wit's end. In fact, I think I remember you telling me that way back when she was 7 months old and you hit the floor with, you know, on your knees to pray for her. That came back to you again, didn't it?
It did. And I knew that that's what I needed to do. And I got on my knees beside her bed. In the morning is when I first did it that day, that fifth day. My daughter, Erin Mary, had called me on her way home from school. And I said, I need you to stay on the phone and pray with me, because Shannon couldn't even talk. And I got on my knees and I knelt at the bedside. And really, something does really change within you when you get on your knees to pray. I can't even describe it. It's just humbling and it's holy and it's beautiful. And that evening, after they whisked her away, right before they whisked her away, I hadn't surrendered fully yet. And they whisked her away, and I had just sent a text out saying, things don't look good, prayers needed, urgent, urgent. And I said, I will be on my knees at 6:45 at her bedside praying, please join me wherever you are and pray for my daughter.
Okay.
And everyone did.
Now, is that point, is this when Father comes in to just say some prayers for her? And
well,
I mean, are they anointing her? And
she had already been anointed, and
okay.
I don't know if you remember it. Father Ridley told me he came in and anointed you. When I was out of the room, he came in and anointed you that day.
Yeah.
But Father Hahn from St. Leo's he had been in touch with me, texting me, and he said, you know, we should have her anointed. And I said, yes, mm-hmm. we've done that. After they whisked her out of the room, I was keeping myself as strong as I could for her at that point. I didn't want to show her how scared I was. And they had done a final tap at that point, and things looked bad. And so they whisked her out of the room, and I was there. And as I left the room, on my left was a nurse, and on my right was this Father Ridley, who appeared out of nowhere. And I just broke down into this nurse Mary's arms and Father Ridley. And the two of them walked me into her new room, and that's when they prayed with her.
Mm-hmm. And then am I right in saying, okay, so but as Father's praying over her and he's leaving the room, you see that Shannon is mouthing Father.
She said Father. And no one could hear her because she couldn't speak. Her voice was so low. Do you remember?
And you called him back.
And she said Father. And I said, Father, Father, wait. Yeah,
don't go.
Don't go if she wants to tell you something. I said, but you have to lean in very close because she has no voice. She can't move her mouth. And she said, I want to receive the Eucharist.
You said that, obviously
he whispered it to him.
And so that had to be difficult because you couldn't even open your mouth, really, but he was able to give you the Eucharist.
Yeah. I told her, just let it dissolve.
Yeah, just let it dissolve. And you're at that point looking out the window trying to maybe hang more of that purple stuff in those pictures.
Yeah, right after he gave her the Eucharist, I turned my back to her to finish hanging these pictures of hope and these verses all around her room. And he had left the room, and that's when I heard her speak.
What did she say?
Mom, can you get me something to eat?
And you probably thought, who's talking?
Yeah. She hadn't eaten. They had her IV all day. She couldn't speak. She could hardly look at me. And I said, oh, yeah, sure. And I'm scurrying around the room.
In shock, probably.
I found her hospital tray that they had delivered at lunchtime. And I said, Shannon, maybe we can heat it and I can cut it. And she said, no, Mom, I want pizza. And I literally fell to the ground. And the nurses came and we ordered her pizza. And honest to God, the only image that I had in my mind was the image from the Bible when Jesus heals the little girl and says to the mother, get that child something to eat.
Yeah. And you did. You did do that. Shannon, how are you feeling at this point? You receive the Eucharist.
Yeah.
You know this is serious. You're thinking you're probably dying.
Yeah.
What happened inside your head?
I mean, it was tough because in my head, I'm kind of like, I honestly was like preparing myself. I really thought I was dying. I've never really been in that spot in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I asked my mom at one point to bring the phone over to me. And I told her I wanted to call a few people. And I called my husband and a couple people just honestly to say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough, but in my head, when Father Ridley came in, I knew he was there. I couldn't really like process what was going on because of how much pain I was still in.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know where it came from, but it really wasn't conscious. Like it just out came the words, like, mm-hmm. I want to receive the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
And
Jesus.
That happened. And I would say it was pretty instant. My head started to finally be relieved.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking, this was on, I think, hour 13.
Mm.
And her pain at this point had been a 15 out of 10.
Did you think at that time or later that Father Michael had some role to play?
Oh, absolutely.
How so?
I 100%. He's always been there. He's just
the bedpost.
Always been in my life. And at one point, I said I could picture on the four bedposts, I pictured Father Michael Judge at one, St. Francis at another, and then two, another priest that had passed away that we were very close with, Father Cashin at another, and then another family friend that had passed away, Stephen McDonald at the other. And I said I could picture all four of them there, and I could see them.
Yeah.
And I knew that Father Michael was with me.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to explain, but I could feel him there.
Amazing.
In that room.
This story is incredible. And they have a beautiful, I've met Luke today. They're a beautiful child that you adopted. And Shannon, you look as healthy. I don't want to say as healthy as a horse, but you know what I'm saying? You look so healthy. It's the most beautiful story. But I want to make sure we get this in before the close of the program in a moment. And that is how people can get involved in this ministry. Are you calling it Michael's Message?
Yeah.
And how they can help continue this, because obviously it's something that you guys are dedicated to, and with good reason. How do they get in touch with your ministry?
We have a website, www.michaelsmessage.org, and it's spelled M-Y-C-H-A-L-S message, because Father Michael had a unique spelling to his name.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a Facebook page. People can write to us. We respond immediately if anybody wants to write to us. And then we have a mailing list if anybody wants to get on it. We send out a newsletter a couple times a year telling people about our projects. Our ministry is Holy Spirit driven, so the projects come to us. In January, Shannon will be celebrating her liver transplant anniversary, and she'll choose her anniversary project. And we haven't decided on that yet. We wait on the Holy Spirit, and as soon as He lets us know, then, you know, we name each project, so each project is special. And people can get involved simply by making a donation of an item. So in a project such as Blessed Bloomers, they can buy a package of underwear and send it to us. And it gets to the streets, to the homeless men that need it.
There's no middlemen here at all.
Yeah.
No. I want to thank the Hickey Lynch family, Sharon, Kelly, Shannon, for joining us at 720 AM Holy Family Radio and sharing the story. But I want to ask you, Kelly, one more time. Give us that website so our listeners can get involved with Michael's message.
Okay. It's www.michaelsmessage.org.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless.